Thanks for tuning in to What It Is on WNCW, taking it on the road and keeping it co-ed today as we are at Echo Mountain Recording Studios in Asheville, North Carolina. I'm Joe Kendrick, joined by Jessica Thomason, Krissa Raquate, Fred Mills, and Woody Wood. And today we're talking about the producer's role in the studio and how an artist or band should look for and choose a producer.
One of the first things is finding what sort of records are you into, what sort of music are you making, and you've heard other records that have influenced you, and kind of checking into that in terms of who's made those records. You'd be surprised, especially in this day and age, the accessibility to some producers that maybe you wouldn't be able to get in touch with in the past. And so taking records and looking at the back of them and seeing who produced that record, you know, and obviously I'm talking about, I couldn't get Rick Rubin to do a Woody record or something like that, you know what I mean? But just being able to find someone who has already making music that's something that you're influenced by is number one. And number two, I think one of the other really big things is once you do actually start to seek someone out is having someone who's excited about the sort of music that you're making. It's a pretty level playing field these days just in terms of where music's at, where money's at. And so there's plenty of people who are still making, doing projects, doing records that they're really passionate about instead of, say, you know, paying somebody $20,000, $30,000 to produce your record. There's people who are willing to do things because they're labors of love, because they really believe in the project and the band.
Well, you know, sometimes you'll read interviews with bands and they'll be talking about making the record. And when the whole process began for them, they said that they sat down going through all their favorite records, and so-and-so's name kept popping up over and over, maybe an engineering credit early in his career and later on producing credits. And that's a good roadmap, I think, for any band. And I've had artists tell me that they would meet with, say, a short list of producers, and, oh, so-and-so, he was okay, but he was aloof. So-and-so just seemed like it was another product. This guy really liked our sound. You know, he seemed to be, you know, kind of copacetic with the type of music we were making. It might be kind of a kind of intangible thing, but I think you're right. They need to find kind of a partner in crime, so to speak.
I think that is the biggest part of it in terms of finding somebody who really cares, who's going to be a part of the band per se, you know, who's going to get in there and actually understand. You know, there's certain producers who have a certain sound to what they do, you know, and so it's just like there's certain producers that just put that stamp on whatever the band is like, this is what I'm going to do to it. Whereas finding somebody who's much more into helping you create what you want to create versus putting their stink on it, so to speak, I think is really important. And you can see that because just like you want to be in a studio that's got a good vibe, same thing, you want to play music with people that you really vibe with. It's the exact same thing.
How does it work with being able to afford a producer, first of all? How does that relationship work a lot of times? Because sometimes producers won't take necessarily cash up front, but they may take points on the record, things like that.
Exactly, yeah. It just depends. It could be anything from producers can get paid per song, depending on what they're going to do, you know, especially now when people are doing EPs and singles and that sort of thing, to getting points on the record, which just basically means getting money on the back end and getting paid per every album song, you know, every album, every song sold.
Or depending on their involvement, maybe in songwriting.
Yeah, and that's credit, true, yeah. Because a lot of producers these days, because where the music industry is and where people are making money, and because people's records are not selling anywhere near what they used to, a lot of producers are doing co-writing with artists, and then that way, you know, they get the copyright credit.
Yeah, well, with record sales, what they are taking points on a record might be a strategy to never getting paid at all.
Exactly.
Know? Well, I think also there's something to be said for the fact that because of the turn in tides in the recording industry, there are a lot of producers who were musicians who have turned to producing because, unfortunately, there are a lot of bands who are putting out records and who are in your face who aren't really the musicians behind the music that you hear. More likely, it might be the producer utilizing their talents as a musician or an arranger or even somebody assisting the producer, you know, depending on their relationship. You know, there are quite a few records. And I mean, that relationship has always existed in the music business, you know, producers like actually understanding, you know, I think a producer, first of all, has to understand how music works mechanically, not necessarily be able to actually play it, but know how it works when you hear it and know a thing or two about music. But, you know, Tom Dowd worked a lot with Aretha Franklin, actually writing out parts on the piano, sitting down, doing things like that, like actively had a role in how the actual songs, the chord structures and everything came out at the end, but in a way of like a nurturing way to where they could get the artist to go on their own, like just start the top spinning and then stand back and let it go.
Well, I think some people might even have this image of a producer as the guy that's just kind of sitting there and you're behind the mixing board, you know, with his eyes closed, his arms folded, just listening to the music. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, that's a real old school attitude that nowadays, you know, some of the best and brightest producers are the ones that, I mean, you hire them and you get their guitar collection and their expertise.
Exactly.
Rolled into the whole package. And that same producer quite often has a guitar credit or a keyboard credit on the album in addition to the you know, the studio credit.
And Jess has said so many times about how the studio aspect of being in the music business, how such a small world and such a family-like atmosphere, everybody knows each other. So a lot of producer-artist deals get worked out in a way where you might not have access to like a great catalog for this producer, but like the feel is right, the attitude is right, you know what I mean? Like, just you just feel something between the two of you, just something clicks and you know it's going to work out. And then it becomes this day by day or week by week thing about how your relationship works out. And that's how the, you know, the album could even be looked at as a way of like, this album started here and its origin and ending is like almost like the same as the relationship that evolved between producer and artist, and look at it that way. Which, you know, going back to the whole pricing thing or how you figure out how somebody's going to get paid for something, is the back end, do I get, you know, points, part of your publishing? It just all depends on those types of things. And for me, I mean, I've only worked with a producer probably four times, and the last time that I did it was like the most in-depth.
What made it different?
Well, because that's exactly the way it was. It was like we hung out together. We talked about things. It was like being in a band with this person. Here's a person that was actually a musician, a guitar player, played the bass, like still made a living like doing producing
music,
but also playing music, you know, which to me was a, you know, that made a huge impact on me. I was like, so you still are out here just like me or anybody else in the trenches because you love music.
Well, we spoke your language
guitar.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And like, yeah, it's funny when you said, you know, you get their guitar collection too. Like, I did, you know.
Yeah.
But I also got the studio's guitar collection too, which is, you know, a whole, with those two together, I felt like, you know, I was just pulling swords out left and right.
Well, you know, I know Mitch Easter over in Kernersville is an old friend of mine. He's worked on a lot of records, REM and more. And when you book his studio, you get Mitch's guitar collection, mm-hmm. too, which is a pretty impressive collection. You know, everything from these vintage 12 strings to an electric sitar and everything else. Mm-hmm. And Mitch, of course, is a longtime musician, and he told me one time I was writing up a retrospective of his career, and he said, from his point of view as a producer and an engineer, the greatest thing in the world is if he's really getting into the music that the people he's recording or making, that it engages him. So it's almost like the mirror image of what you just mm-hmm. described, is if the producer is having a good time too and feeling like the same language is being spoken, then it's just a creative meshing, and that may be why some of the greatest records, you know, come out of those kinds of relationships. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask Krissa, now you've worked with Ben Salee mm-hmm. a lot. Who was Ben Salee's producer?
Ben Salee's producer is Dwayne Lundy in Kentucky, and it's a gentleman that he's worked with before. He's got a relationship with him. I mean, because of being from Lexington, they both have that relationship. I think it was previous, it might have been previous to making the albums, but he made Learning to Bend with Dwayne, and then he also made this new album inclusions with Dwayne, and you know, they just have a kinetic energy together that Ben feels Dwayne listens to him and helps him move things along, but then also puts his own type of sound on there.
Now, Tony Visconti is in Kentucky too, isn't he? It seems like a lot of studios and producers are popping up away from the major centers like L.A. and New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a little place called Echo Mountain down in Asheville,
yeah,
North Carolina,
that's right.
Kind of a reputation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that brings to mind the other thing, too, is certain producers develop a fondness for a particular facility that might be a good relationship with the people there, or they just might like the vibe and the layout and everything, and they'll keep coming back. I mean, do you guys find that to be true, that a person will come to Echo Mountain and want to come back for another project?
Yeah, that's we get a lot of repeat business, and so we've had people come in a number of times. For instance, the guy that I told you about, there's a producer named Dan Hannon who's from Atlanta, and he's worked with Manchester Orchestra and a lot of other indie bands, and he's got his own production company, and I was hoping he'd be here today because he's coming in with a project, and he has three projects just in the next 2 months that he's bringing here, and these are his fourth, fifth, and sixth projects this year alone.
Wow.
So that's a lot. But we did a record with Steve Martin, and Gary Pachoza was the producer on that project with Tony Trischka. And Gary is the vice president of A&R for Sugar Hill Records. He also brought us the Dierks Bentley record, and he's coming back this fall again with another record that he's bringing here. So we do get a lot of repeat business and get a lot of producers who want to bring other projects in. We've been getting a lot of work from Nashville and in other places like that, and Dan Hannon's from Atlanta, because even when they're working with bands that are from there, they want to get them out of their natural habitat and away from their friends and their family so that they can really focus on making a record and just come here for a week and get immersed in it.
Now, sometimes artists wind up not using a producer, like, say, the new Elin Jewel record, which I adore, and it's produced by her, written by her. It's like a one-woman show almost in a lot of respects. Or you'll see bands like Chatham County Line go mm-hmm. away from having a producer to produce their own record the last go around. And I guess sometimes that's going to have good and bad results. Anybody ever have any observations about when an artist should or shouldn't have produced a record themselves?
When you can produce it yourself, then that's, you know, you got to know enough about it. Like, it's not just something, you can't just go into a studio or get behind some microphones and put somebody in front of it and be like, I'm going to produce this. It's like, there's a talent there. There's a lot of knowledge that you have to have about how recording devices work, like setting up microphones, bleed. Just, you have to have a real wisdom and knowledge to produce a record. You know, even if it's your own thing, it doesn't matter if it's your own songs. I would say that when you see people, well, Jimmy Page produced the first Led Zeppelin album. Jimmy Page had been a session musician he had been in the studio since he was like 15 years old.
And he'd probably been taking notes all his life.
Exactly. So, like, that's why, you know, he can do that. And those other bands that you've mentioned already are like extremely talented folks and artists. And I think that would be the first thing. It's like, if you ain't done it, you know, you probably can't. You know what I mean?
But I've read liner notes too before, where the producer is basically admitting that they just went out and got the coffee, or they were basically just ornamental.
I think guys that say that stuff are just being backing off, and I've talked to a lot of folks who think that's exactly what a producer's job is supposed to be. You know, it's like I said, like, I'm just getting you turned in this direction, and like making sure you're focused and where you need to be as a band right here, and just stepping back. And then if stepping in and being like, you know what, that change to that bridge just don't work, let's talk about that. And you talk about it, and then okay, you guys go and do it. What I guess what I'm saying is, there's some producers who think their job is to remain back as far as possible and just like, there's my name on there and that's cool, and you don't really know how much involvement I had. And then there are other people like what you're talking about, like I say Daniel Lanois and stuff like that, you know, folks like mm-hmm. that, who are like, this is what your album's going to sound like. It doesn't matter whether you're U2 or Willie Nelson or who you are, it's what your album's going to sound like.
I think, there's two different, there's producers and artists that really collaborate together. And that's what I really enjoy, just that part of being in the studio and working together versus a band coming in. I mean, because I've seen both, and it's not necessarily like one is better than the other. It just depends on the person of the band and how they work together. But there's people who come in and are just like, let the producer take over. Like, tell us what to do. What should we sound like? And then there's other bands, which I think as they work on more and more records, start to get to the point where they either want to do it themselves or they know what they want to sound like. And so they're like, hey, let's work on this together and see, this is what I'm trying to achieve. And the producer's role is to help them do that to the best of their ability and help out in any way that's going to make what they can do even better.
Well, it will hinge on that. A lot of what Woody said too is the experience that the artist builds up over time, I think, is key. I mean, I remember talking to Don Dixon. I used to live in Charlotte, and I would hang out at Reflection Studios sometimes. And Don Dixon, everybody listening to WNCW, I'm sure, is familiar with him. He did a lot of projects in Reflection, and he said every band was different. Sometimes his job would literally be watching the budget and watching the clock, because you know the record company had tasked him to get this project done in a certain amount of time. And maybe it's a band's getting stuck on a song, and he says, guys, we got to move on. Maybe we should just try another song, come back to this if there's time later. He said some artists, you know, his job is more like a babysitter. Mm-hmm. And of course, back in the, I think nowadays, artists might be a little bit more aware that you don't want to come to the studio wasted. You're there to work, but maybe things were a lot more freewheeling and years past, and Don said he literally would have to pick some people up at the motel and put them in the shower and sober them up and get them to the studio. and he said then, and others, it really was just helping them, as you say, work on a bridge, figure out maybe a different set of backing vocals that kind of sync with the arrangement more. But he said his role was always changing just depending on the band or the artist he was working with.
A producer could even take a song and just change the entire tempo of it and make it sound completely different than how it started, and the artist will be happy with the new sound and be like, okay, well, that never really sounded right to me. And now having this objective opinion mm-hmm. come in and help you take that song and bring it to where the artist might have intended it to go. And just, you know, I also feel like a good reason to have a producer is that an artist might become too much of a perfectionist in the way the song should sound, and having a producer that's like, okay, well, I think this is done. We've laid it out, we've chopped it up, here it is, and it's done. You're good. It's finished.
So artists can't see the forest for the trees.
Absolutely.
And the producer can pull that out for them.
Mm-hmm. That is an extremely important point to make. I'm totally guilty of that myself as well. And I see that happen all the time. It's just like, you know, you want to be a perfectionist at your craft, or it might just be you're continually questioning what you're doing. It's nice to have that, like, partnership together, you know. And that, you know, the last thing that I did working with Roger, that was the agreement that we made, was that, like, he's like, hey, man, you know, we're going to talk about these things. And, like, that was our relationship together, was like this. Him helping me see things that I couldn't see, because, you know, you never see your music and what you're doing in the light that other people do. You know, you got too many filters that you look at it through. That's an extremely important thing to have right there.
Well, you know, if an artist says he does not need an extra set of ears, mm-hmm. I won't go so far as to say that artist is delusional, because there are some artists that have been at their craft for so long and they're so good at it that you can't even imagine them working with an outside party. But I think by and large, that extra perspective, particularly if you hit a spot where you're just blocked, you know, and writer's block, recorder's block, whatever you want to call it, that guy can step in and say, well, look at it in this light, you know, twist it around just a little bit. And like you said, there's been many examples of a producer coming up with a new arrangement, slowing the tempo, speeding it up, mm-hmm. maybe moving a bridge around, and all of a sudden, that's the song that becomes the hit. Mm-hmm. And the artists should love them for it.
One of those that I specifically remember was the Counting Crows album, August and Everything After. T-Bone Burnett produced that. And I remember in an interview, the Counting Crows were saying how Perfect Blue Buildings, which is like a really slow, legato, like kind of sad song, originally started as a march. And T-Bone was like, yeah, that's not really working for you. Let's flip that. And it's a beautiful song.
T-Bone's unique anyway in that he's got a very unusual set of ears. And, you know, he started out just as a recording artist himself. Mm-hmm. So he has that double perspective. I mean, he's one of the most respected producers on the planet. You know, I remember seeing him play at the Cat's Cradle in Chapel Hill when he was touring his second album. And at that point, I don't know if he'd even dipped into producing at all.
When was this?
This was, what was that? It was the album that had Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend.
How long ago was this?
Oh, this was like in the early, mid-80s.
Wow.
So long before our brother, Where Art Thou, and everything. So T-Bone's a classic example of what we were talking about earlier, is somebody that speaks the same language as musicians and has been up through the ranks, has done the time, you know, at the, you know, so to speak, at the foot of other producers and everything, and has turned all that knowledge and all that experience into just pure recording gold.
You know, another thing I would say, I think is completely safe to say, is that most producers that are worth their salt have spent a great deal of time sitting behind a board having somebody say, hey, man, make it sound like this. You know what I mean? I need you to do that. Cut this part out. I mean, like actually engineering sessions and things like that. They develop their ear that way. That's a, you know, to add on to what we were talking about earlier, that's another important part of, I think, producing somebody is like just not just knowing that, but knowing your way around a studio, how to get, you know, like you were saying, I think going back to what you were talking about people that just sat there and like looked over and, you know, those are probably maybe the babysitters or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like you know, they just kind of were A&R people that went in there smoking cigars and were like, okay, sounds good to me. I'll go report back.
Or they asked, like, can you make it not sound so tinny? I was like, what does that mean?
I've heard this story from four different people in four different genres of music about recording albums, right? Producers in there. A&R from the record label comes in, says the stupidest thing in the world. Like, hey, you know, can you add some of this? Or, you know, just saying things. They have no idea what they're talking about. And so they'll go, yeah, sure, let me work on that. Let me do that. Come back. I'll play it for you again. And they'll go like, okay. And they don't do anything to it. They call them up on the phone and say, hey, I got it ready for you. I got your mix ready for you. Come back. And they're, oh, man, that's exactly what I was talking about. That's so beautiful. It's like that whole thing, like being at a live show and playing music and you tell the sound guy, like, hey, man, give me some more of this or that. And you have the guy go like, pretend to push the fader.
Yeah.
You know, and I've seen, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, Julie knows what I'm talking about. You know, you sit there and I've seen this and it's funny, you know, because the singer will be like, yeah, man, that's good. Yeah. The guy didn't even push the fader at all.
Well, that's
it's like the FU fader.
Yeah. Well, see, that's one of those other roles that Dixon didn't mention, the producer, illusionist and psychiatrist all rolled into one. Yeah. You know, I talked to Jim Dickinson, rest his soul, one time in Austin, and I had to ask him if it was true, because I'd heard this story when he was recording Green on Red in Memphis about Danny Stewart, the lead singer, had indulged just a little bit too much LSD that particular weekend and was a little wild in the studio and said he was throwing these karate chops at everybody. So he was doing these karate chops and kicks near Dickinson's head, and so Dickinson... And he verified this is a true story. He just kind of leans back, you know, in the chair and says, slow down, Elvis. You had a little bit too much. Let's get back to work. And it just bummed Danny out so much that he went and cowered in the corner for the rest of the session. And so Chuck Prophet and the rest of the guys could finish, you know, getting it all done. But there again, you know, it's Dickinson was playing that role of the psychiatrist and babysitter. All rolled into one at that point, too. I'm sure that if we had some of these producers, they could tell us a lot of great off-the-record stories of things that are supposed to never be revealed to the public.
There is a book, if anybody is interested in reading it, called The Diary of Mixer Man.
I've read that. That we is have hilarious.
Had Mixer Man in the studio.
Oh, do you know? Do you know Mixer Man?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Can you give his disclose his name?
I don't.
You're probably sworn to secrecy.
I don't think you should.
I don't think I can. Yeah. I think it's better not to. But
you got
to
tell me
even
after
if you can.
He is hilarious. But this book,
he's not a real person, right?
He is a real person. Yeah, yeah, he's right. a real producer.
And all the people in the book are real people.
And all the people in the book are real people, but their names have been changed.
The guilties have been changed to protect the innocent.
As you had said earlier. But it is a great, great read. It's hilarious. If you want to read about a band who is in the studio, and granted, I wouldn't even call it anywhere near a typical session, because that's not a typical session. But if you want to know how a recording project goes wrong, this is the one to read. And it tells you a lot about the process, but also about the relationships that we've been talking about. It tells you about the producer. It tells you about this band who had a bidding war over them and then was sentenced to write for 2 years and is finally getting an opportunity to record. They have an unlimited budget. Most of them cannot play to save their lives, but for some reason they signed to $1 million deal. And then it's all from the perspective of the engineer on the session. But it's hilarious.
Well, apparently he was blogging about it.
Yeah.
And turned it into a book.
Yeah.
Totally entertaining. What was it? The Adventures of Mixer Man?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The title of it?
Yeah. You know, that's what it is. Adventures
there's another good one that Al Cooper wrote called Backstage Passes and Backstabbing Bastards, I think is the name of the book. And he's got a lot of great stories of both as a musician and a performer as well as a producer. And the usual musical memoir is you know, if I have read another music book about crash and burn, rehab and redemption story, I'm going to throw up. But the ones that are really good are the behind the scenes stories that we really want to hear. And the Mixer Man is a good example of that.
The thing about that Mixer Man book too that stands out for me is because you know, like you were talking about earlier about having somebody to help you be like, hey, this is done, this is shaved down, or like you mentioned being a psychologist. This is from, you get this inner perspective of this guy working on this session, right? And so he's telling his thoughts on it. And he's putting this picture in your mind of like, I am really a patient person because I'm telling you now what I'm dealing with and I didn't blow up on anybody today in the studio. You know what I mean? And so that's the other thing, going back to like working on a record with somebody and being a producer is like, you know, like when it comes time to cut vocals, you know, there's a big deal made out of when it comes time to cut vocals on a record. And if you're the singer, you know, everybody makes a big deal to you about it. Like, hey, man, we're getting ready to do the vocals. Hey, man, you know, hey, I just wanted to remind you that in 2 weeks we're going to be cutting vocals. Are you ready? You've been working on the lyrics. Okay, great. So talk to you later. Okay. And then the phone rings 10 minutes later. Hey, I wanted to remind you that I just called you 10 minutes ago to tell you that we're going to be cutting vocals in 2 weeks. All right. You know, and the time comes, you psych yourself out and you're getting everything ready to go. You know, you need somebody that is big enough and open enough and wide enough as a person, you know, that can come in and like, you know, pat you on the back and be like, man, it's okay, you know, let me boost your ego a little bit in a safe and healthy, positive way, you know what I mean? And get you through that. Like, there's a lot of psychology that goes into it. Like, I think you can't just know about music. I think you have to be like your personal scope, you know, your consciousness, your awareness, your personal experience as a human being has to be fairly wide, you know, because musicians are a bunch of crazy, you know, out there, unfocused folks, most of us are. Okay,
really?
I'll speak for myself. But anyway.
You're kidding.
But you know what I'm saying? So, to have to deal with
that
sort of
there.
Thing. And then, but you know, like I said, going back to reading the book about Mixer Man, to read and be like, and then I wonder what people think of sessions that I've been, I wonder what they would write about after a day of working with me.
Oh, you probably don't want
you
to
know, I mean?
Know that, do you?
You know, it's like, I would hope that nobody would write that stuff about any session that I've been on. But you know what I mean? Just putting into perspective of, like, you know, personal relationships. That has a lot to do with, like finishing a record. Like, if people are mad at each other, if the band's mad at each other, if the producer and the artist are, like, button heads and not talking to each other about why they're aggravated, it just holds up the whole process, gums up the whole works.
Well, not everybody it's producing probably is not the kind of job that you can just wake up one morning and says, you know, I'm either going to be a fireman or a producer and decide, okay, producer. I think I'm sure a lot of guys would, ladies and men would that are in producing would verify this, that it's something that they kind of evolve into. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that there are classes you can take for, you know, studio engineering and record producing and everything. Mm-hmm. But I think by and large, it's not something that, you know, you just plan out from day one like you would if you're going to medical school or something.
Yeah, when I was 13, none of my friends had posters of Phil Ramone hanging on their walls.
Yeah.
It's always, you know, like
the I have seen a players. Poster of Rick Rubin just because he looks so awesome.
Yeah.
With that beard, he looks more like a guru than a producer.
You know, he kind of is. He has this thing where he likes to meditate.
He's kind of mystic.
Before sessions and stuff like that, yeah.
What do you think? Email us whatitis@wncw.org. Your thoughts on being a producer and the relationship between an artist and the studio and whether you should produce a record yourself. Can you afford a producer at all? Let us know your thoughts and we'll highlight your comments on our weekend wrap-up of the show on Friday. I'm Joe Kendrick for WNCW, joined by Jessica Thomason, also Chris Araquate, Fred Mills, and Woody Wood. Until next time.